guys. This is The Conversation. It's episode 150. 150. Get out your champagne or Pabst Blue Ribbon, as the case may be, with guest Jessica Backus of Artsy. Not only of Artsy, but she has been through quite a few factions of the art world. She was with Perez Projects in Berlin and Phillips Auction House in New York. And she went to Hunter for graduate school, my graduate school alma mater in New York. And of course, we talk about Artsy as well, arguably the biggest digital art platform out there. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for The Conversation is theconversationpod.com, where you can see images that we talk about, probably from Perez Projects days and certainly from Artsy days, as well as some works by some of the artists that she worked with. You can also, if you would like to fill out the survey that we have on the site to learn more about you and your tastes for future programming, you can go to theconversationpod.com/survey, and we would really appreciate it if you filled that out. Ideally, 7, 8, 9 in particular, if you only want to do a partial fill out, that would be really helpful. So, yeah, we really cover a lot of ground, and without further ado, I think we should go ahead and get right into it with Jessica Backus of Artsy. Thank you very much for being here. I'm going to talk to you a little bit more on the back end, so do stick around. In the meantime, hope you enjoy this conversation. Talk to you then. So how are things at Artsy?
They're great. There's a lot going on always. We have our company retreat coming up in a few days, which is when like everyone flies in from all over the globe, and we go to this like small place in upstate New York that I think some of the like Olympians have trained at before. So it feels very much like we're preparing for a sporting event. But it's a great time for us to kind of like reconnect and focus on the bigger picture. So that's like on a more personal level, I guess, what we have coming up. And otherwise, it's definitely an exciting time for us. You know, we've kind of recently launched two new businesses in addition to our main business. And so just, you know, seeing those through the rest of the year.
You just changed positions recently. Why don't you tell me what you were and what you're doing now?
I did, yeah. So up until about 2 weeks ago, I was the director of Artsy Learning and the Art Genome Project. So most of what that entails is leading up the Art Genome Project, which is Artsy's sort of, we call it an art search engine, an art discovery engine, if you will. It's basically a team of art historians who catalog the artists and artworks on the site using a controlled vocabulary of about 1,000 art-related terms. Mm-hmm. So anything from, you know, stained glass effect or Clausenism to, you know, impressionism or like mediated view is a certain technique for framing, you know, the view of an artwork. So we use those terms to catalog artworks and artists, and then that creates this really rich data set that can fuel discovery on the site. And so from that, I actually transitioned into my new position, which is very different, but I'm actually leading up a team of about 20 gallery relations liaisons, we call them. Mm-hmm. So we work with Artsy's gallery partners, who are really like the lifeblood of our business in a large extent. They are, you know, the primary source of content of artists and artworks on the site, and we work with them to make them successful on the platform.
Right. So in other words, you have a number of galleries that are part of Artsy's database that have their artists' works up, and visitors to Artsy who collect via Artsy potentially, if not find art through Artsy, get a commission based on purchases through you.
Well, like, yes and no. So our model is, most of all, that's correct, right? So our model is galleries, you know, put their programs on Artsy, and then collectors, but also, you know, general members of the public, curators, the press can use the site to browse and discover. We don't actually take a commission from our galleries. We do charge them a monthly fee to list on the platform. And I should also mention that, you know, for galleries, galleries get a lot of different things out of the platform. You know, there really is no one art world, and in the same way, there's no one gallery mold and one reason to be on Artsy. And so some of them are on the site, you know, primarily to make sales. Of course, that's what galleries are there for. But a lot of them also see a huge exposure opportunity in it. They, you know, they want to reach the broader public. They want to reach the press and curators who use the site. And then the third part of what we offer, of course, are tools. So we have a number of tools that galleries use to manage their inventory, to, you know, manage their online brand, and as well as, you know, kind of a suite of like iPad apps and some, you know, various other services that we're always developing.
Mm-hmm. So if I'm a gallery and I'm considering signing up for Artsy's services, what are you going to tell me that makes it appealing? I mean, other than some of the things you've already said, as far as the accessibility, what are some of the best-selling points for that gallery?
Oh, good. Well, you're putting me on the spot now, and I actually I don't sell to our galleries. I just make sure that they're getting everything that they can out of the platform that they signed up for.
Right.
But
well, you know what? Let me ask you an adjacent question that might be a little more fair then, or a little bit less putting you on the spot, which is, how would you describe very briefly Artsy to me as, you know, as a general platform, maybe particularly in relation to what we're talking about regarding your gallery partnerships?
Sure. So we like to think of Artsy as the art world online, which is, of course, very multifaceted. It's very global. And it brings together, you know, huge swaths of the art world. So when we think about what the art world is, you know, galleries are a huge part of it. Galleries, by extension, work with artists to create artworks. And that's where we have been focusing our efforts really from the beginning. But it also means working with institutions and museums and artists' estates. It means having an editorial platform to provide the context and news coverage that is really, you know, important part, kind of the stories and the glue of the art world in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it also means creating, you know, products that can sort of replicate some of the, you know, beautiful serendipity that is the art world as well. So things like discovery, things like, you know, being able to see artworks in the best possible lighting situation, and having a sense of how they might appear in your own space. We have a view and room feature, for example. So those are kind of what I think I would say the overall facets of Artsy are. And when you start drilling down into it, of course, it becomes quite complex. You know, we also have some commercial auction houses on the platform and some benefit auctions. We also have an art fairs team that works directly with art fairs and our partners on the ground there. You know, what this all means to the user in the end is, you know, of course, we have incredibly savvy users who have been collectors for many years. Maybe their parents have been collectors as well. And they are very interested in seeing all of the individual players of the art world all in one location. But I think for a casual user, they're not so concerned. If they just want to, say, view all of, like, Robert Rauschenberg's artworks, they're not so concerned on whether or not those are listed with a gallery or whether they're from the Robert Rauschenberg Foundation or whether they're being listed through one of our, you know, institutional partners. They kind of just want to be able to have, you know, a primary resource for discovering an artist's work. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what some of the power of the website is that you can use it if you're a, you know, very advanced user, and, you know, very skilled at navigating all of the players of the art world. But you can also kind of find, you know, more sort of content-based, thematic-based, and sort of artist-based inroads for discovery.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a typical Artsy user, or in other words, I'm wondering if there are a number of users who can access the art world through your platforms that they wouldn't be able to, that they can't because they're not in an art center. Whereas people in art centers, you know, have a more on hands-on access, but they maybe still use the site for, you know, its easy access.
Oh, totally. So, I mean, we've done, I don't know all of the numbers off the top of my head, but what I do know is that there was one year at Artsy where I think we had visitors from every single country except for those countries in which Artsy is blocked. Mm-hmm. And maybe actually even in some of those countries. So I think we have users in something like 190 different countries, mm-hmm. and in a huge number of cities beyond that. I know also too that when we're looking at buyers and sellers on the platform, the average distance for sales that happened on the platform between a buyer and seller is almost 3,000 miles. Mm. So, you know, the art world itself is very global, and I think it's not so surprising that we see that number reflected in an online platform like Artsy. What I think really interests me, though, is that we have, like, the entire world using it to discover artists, to browse. And that I think, is really exciting. I can also mention that we do have a very large percentage of our audience who is really just looking to learn about artists and to read our magazine. I think our magazine is actually on pace to become the most widely read arts publication by the end of the year. So I think that just speaks to the huge desire out there to, I think, actually learn about art of our day in a way that is, you know, not pretentious, in a way that's inviting. And that gets me really excited to think about the fact that there is actually an outlet now for people who want to make art an actual part of their lives and feel like they are part of this, you know, bigger ecosystem, even if they're not, you know, friends with galleries or friends with artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, mentioning the traffic that you're talking about made me, and I was going to ask about this anyway, but I was thinking about your Instagram, your large Instagram following, and I don't know if that's much more of a, you know, different sort of a numbers section or engineering section of the business, but I guess I want to know to what extent those Instagram posts are targeted or connected to recent activity, or if it's a little bit more random than that.
Oh, that's a good question. Let me see what I can do to reconstruct that, because so for us, social media is a really interesting part of the new economy, I think, mm-hmm. and different companies have to figure out what they want to use it for. So Artsy is also interesting because we're kind of three businesses in one, right? We're a media business. We have a magazine. We actually, you know, make money with that. We have a, you know, sort of a listings business with where we work with galleries to sell artwork for them. And we also have an auctions business. Mm-hmm. And so if you like looked at analogies for each of those businesses in the real world, they would all use social media in an entirely different way. Mm-hmm. Some would only use it for marketing. Some would probably use it, you know, only to increase page views. You know, like, I think that one of the biggest uses of social media out there is by media companies, by everything from the New York Times to BuzzFeed, where that is a huge distribution channel for them. So, you know, what I would say to kind of try to actually answer your question mm-hmm. now is that we've really nested our social media team under our media business. So what that means is that we see them really as like an extension of our editorial platform for the most part. So they get to have, you know, a lot of autonomy and by extension, there's a lot of fun with what they're doing. Mark Rosen, who leads up that team, is a really great guy. He actually studied like museum education and he was working as a museum educator and tour guide for a while in New York. So I think that he really thinks a lot about like, how do you integrate the online experience with things that are actually happening on the ground? How do you make art fun? How do you make access to art fun?
Mm-hmm. With your new gig, you're already underway being this liaison? I mean, is that the right word to go back to what you were saying earlier? Are you sort of meeting with galleries on a regular basis? Is that a big part of your work?
Not exactly. I mean, I do meet with galleries. I have a lot of friends at galleries, and I also like to meet with them just to kind of get a sense of what their needs are on the platform and what their programs are. Mostly I work with the team of liaisons, though. So I manage about 20 people, and I'm sure you could imagine that alone is a full enough time job.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how you you led up to this point, because it's something that people listening don't have any sense of, since we haven't alluded to it at all. And one of the big things that we talked about before was your auction work. So do you want to talk about how you arrived at that, and we can see where that goes?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I mean, if you want to ask me how I arrived at my auction work, you're going to make me go a little bit further back. So I'm just trying to figure out how far back to trace things. But, you know, I kind of got my start, I guess, working in the arts at a gallery called Perez Project in Berlin. And it was a really exciting time. You know, I started working there in 2006, and the gallery had really just opened. Javier Perez, the owner, had actually been in LA before that. This was his second space. And we had to just get operations running from the ground up. He already had a bit of a following, and was known for representing a lot of these sort of downtown New York male artists like Dash Snow and Dan Colin and Terrence Coe. And there was actually this like big cover on New York Magazine called, I think the title was something like Warhol's Children, maybe with a question mark. And it had like Ryan McGinley, whom he didn't represent, but, you know, knew Dash Snow and Dan Colin all spooning in a bed together. So that was, and I'm not sure if you know Dash Snow or if any of your listeners do, but he was kind of this, you know, enfant terrible of the art world,
right?
Quite a force, you know, not originally an artist, but just kind of a man about town on the scene in New York, and started taking Polaroids and doing collages, and had a really quick, you know, spike in his fame, and ultimately died of a heroin overdose. So it was a pretty wild time, and it was a pretty, you know, well-known wild roster of artists. And this was all happening also at the time that the art world, the kind of golden age was, or the gilded age maybe, was
right,
like ramping up. And there were, you know, there were times that I remember like having to book helicopter rides for the gallerist or for other people. And
where were the rides? You know, where are the rides to?
Oh, there was a party in Mykonos, and like all of the water taxis were booked, so we had to get him there.
Okay, and wait, let's back up for a second. This is good stuff. So,
sure.
So starting with your job with Perez Projects in Berlin, did you get the job and then go to Berlin, or were you already in Berlin and you got the job?
I was already in Berlin. So I had studied German studies in undergrad. And in part, there's actually like a bit of a story there to take us off track.
Sure, not at all. Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Well, you know, I thought I wanted to study art or art history. You know, when you start undergrad at the age of 18, I was doing a lot of dance. Maybe I wanted to be a choreographer, maybe an art historian. Didn't quite know, but I took Rosalind Krauss's class. Knowing that she was a bit of a celebrity, but not really knowing a lot of background on her. And I think it was the second art history class I had ever taken at Columbia. And I remember on the first day, she showed a drawing by Picasso, I think that was in her collection. And she spent like the entire hour and a half of class talking about like signs and signifiers. And now, of course, I know that this is a huge part of her theory. And it's a really interesting part of modernism, of course, is thinking generally about the question of how meaning is produced and, you know, what the difference is between visual meaning and linguistic meaning. And while I can kind of appreciate those questions now, at the time, I just was so baffled by this approach to art.
Mm-hmm.
It ran so counter to all of my instincts and all of my ideas about what art was about or what it could do, or even about how I wanted to be talking about it. So I actually dropped the class about halfway through the semester and kind of ran away from art history right into even more critical theory when I decided to study comparative literature and society.
Right. And this is the great time, which I alluded to when I spoke to you earlier, to mention my own secondhand Rosalind Krauss story. Okay, well, I took a class of hers at Hunter College, which is you where you went for grad school, right? Am I remembering right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
And I think this was a class which I happened to miss. One of my fellow students, who was a really smart guy, and so this is what Roe, this is this Israeli guy's name, this is what he told me. He said, I wrote him saying that I was going to be speaking to somebody who had a class with Rosalind Krauss, and I wanted to know what he remembered, and I told him my version. And he said, in fact, I remember this scene quite well. She was talking about Manet and the way the integrity of subject matter is replaced by an emphasis on the surface, fragmentation, flatness. At which point I raised my hand and mentioned Bataille's book on Manet, where he speaks on the enigmatic faces of Manet's subjects, the opaque frontal gaze of Olympia and others. She became alarmingly red in the face and furiously said something like, "I respect Bataille, but the book on Manet is his worst, and this kind of comment is not constructive." Slammed her books shut and left the class. And then he added at the end, "I think everyone was shocked, but I also remember being amazed at how reproachfully some of her admiring students looked at me."
Right. Yeah, that sounds about right. That is an amazing anecdote.
Yeah.
Sure. No, that sounds about right. Yeah. You know, I can say that, you know, besides Rosalind Krauss, I mean, I do, gosh, how much do I want to dig myself into a hole here? I mean, I do remember, like, working with, so I did comparative literature and society at Columbia. That was this total non-major, and it was just cobbled together out of a lot of different disciplines. And it also turned out that Gayatri Spivak was the undergraduate advisor the year that I was a senior. Now, if you know at all Gayatri Spivak, I mean, she is like a celebrity of celebrities in the comp lit world. And I was just, and to a certain extent, I was in awe of her. You know, in one of her classes, I remember it was actually a graduate class, which I was really lucky to get into as an undergrad. And we all went around the room, you know, saying the project that we were working on. And she speaks, you know, her writing is just so typical of the, you know, sort of post-structuralist comp lit vein. It is incredibly dense, you know, multiple clauses nested within each other. Huge numbers of terms borrowed from psychoanalysis and Marxist theory, and just a general proclivity for foreign terms. You know, I think that she like translated Foucault from the French, right? So that is her, that's her background. And I remember she spoke like that. And it was so impressive, though, that she could start a sentence and it would be transcribed. It would be, you know, an entire paragraph long, with like numerous diversions, but all somehow like grammatically correct, and get to the end of it. And it was just like mic drop, you know, I mean, she was brilliant in that way, but we were going around the room and one poor student said what they were working on. It was something about the, you know, the praxis of speech in like Arabian literature. And she just stopped and was like, "Praxis, like, why do you say praxis? Do you just mean practice?" And the student was like, "Well, I guess." And, you know, Gayatri Spivak's response was just, "If there's a perfectly good English term, just use that. Otherwise, it's pretentious." It was like, wow, like this coming from the woman
right.
for whom like every second word is a foreign word. I do have to say it is things like that that definitely gained my respect for her. And then I did have like one other run-in with her on the elevator of the philosophy building at Columbia. We were heading up and she had actually just finished giving a talk down in the foyer. And I stepped on and another, I think a graduate student, probably someone who had attended the talk, stepped in as well. And Gayatri Spivak, me and this grad student are sitting in the elevator, which is just going painstakingly slow up to the seventh floor. And this grad student turns to her and is like, well, you're Gayatri Spivak. And Spivak says, yes, I am. And the student's like, you're, you know, renowned at, you know, Columbia. I mean, in the discipline. And Spivak turns to her and says, in the world.
Oh man, that is awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah. So,
well, here, let's
and
let's,
yet somehow,
let's, yeah,
oh,
go ahead.
I was
I'm sorry.
Just
go ahead.
Say, and yet somehow, given all of that, I had a desire to go back to grad school. So I don't know. I don't know what was wrong in that calculation.
And what was your concentration in grad school? Was it art history?
It was art history. Yeah. So I got an MA in art history at Hunter, and I focused on mostly like post-war European art. And I did my thesis on an East German artist. So I did myself no favors by focusing on an East German artist, but it was a really, really fascinating thing to work on.
Right. And so what I was going to ask or sort of try to dig into is, I think we're kind of alluding to, or I don't know if we're lightly alluding to it or more directly, but the sort of ivory tower aspects of academia are are just, you know, they're it's a very narrow field, you know, and it's a very it's very uninviting, you know, to students, you know, and by extension, people who get into art, you know. And I think you could, if you were to sort of, you could draw various strands out, reverberations from that reality. And one of them, one of the big ones that would be the sort of the street art kind of reaction, you know, which is like, you know, juxtapose and so on, you know, it's like everything that that's not in a way. I, you know, I just want to point that out, but I guess I also wondered as you were talking earlier about kind of your combination of awe and, you know, and then maybe, you know, the rest kind of speaks for itself towards this, this guru. If things had been, you know, maybe a little bit different, if you would have pursued comparative literature further, I mean, do you think that was, you know, do you think that's in your DNA despite what you encountered?
That's a good question. I will say I've definitely asked myself that before, just in part because I do find myself really drawn to language generally, you know, whether it's foreign languages or the English language. And I think that's also ultimately what brought me back around to the Art Genome Project. And it's often been one of my inroads as well in art and the study of art. And that's what's also kind of funny is that, you know, when you think about the October group, in many ways, their approach is very linguistic, or it's borrowed from the field of semiotics.
Right.
So maybe it's just that actually, you know, sometimes, I don't know, when you're too close to something, it's, you want it to be perfect or a perfect vision of what you would have it be. And maybe Rosalind Krauss's approach was almost too close to, for comfort for me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do... I do think that what's tough in, you know, art historians in general are actually a very verbal bunch. And as a discipline, you know, it really what it is it's about verbalizing these things that can't speak for themselves. And I think in many ways that it's not so far removed from comparative literature in that sense. And especially because comparative literature is also very interdisciplinary. And if I had to define it, I don't actually know if I could for you. I know it looks at a lot of different disciplines to analyze things as text. And I think what it comes down to is whether you see things as text, you know, as conveying like linguistic meaning, or if you see things as conveying a different type of meaning, whether that's visual or, you know, performative or whatnot. And that might be the dividing line between the two disciplines.
And as you were saying that, I was remembering too, going back to the, you know, this divide between that part of academia, the comparative literature / you know, literary corner of academia. And then your, you know, I mentioned the sort of street art, but just going back to what we were talking about with you before, with Perez projects, you know, and Dash No. Mm-hmm. I mean, that kind of exemplifies mm-hmm. sort of the other side as well. So you're in Berlin mm-hmm. doing this study, and you need a job at a certain point, and that's when you connect right. with Perez projects? Right. And
I mean, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it happened. I had no intention. You know, I saw people working at galleries, and it was, you know, that was around like 2006, as I mentioned. It's so crazy, too, how in the last 10 years, how much the art world has changed. But even then, you know, there was this type of gallery girl who existed, or the gallerinas, or whatever you want to call them. And, you know, I was a little bit like, is that the type of person I want to be? Is that the type of person I am? You know, I don't have parents to subsidize my rent. Can I live in that world and be amongst those people? And I think in the end, you know, it was a job, and that's why I took it. But there was something that drew me to it. You know, there was something about working with artists, being, you know, many of them had their studios nearby. I loved just being able to be there on the ground at that, you know, seeing the development, for example, of these like odd bits of materials turn into actual ideas and turn into actual objects and then ultimately turn into works of art. And that sort of alchemical process is something that I still find really fascinating. And mm-hmm. I think that kind of attracted me to the job and is ultimately what kept me really happy in it.
Right. So were you doing then, I don't know if, it's interesting, that gallerina, you know, thing. I don't know if as a woman working at a gallery, you automatically become a gallerina. And I think it has a lot to do, it has a lot to do with what gallery it is, obviously, and the vibe that they put out. And I think Perez Projects, from what I remember of it, didn't really put out much of that vibe. But all that to ask, were you doing a little bit of everything? I mean, you alluded to that you were seeing what the artists were doing. So were you doing, you know, the sort of basic administrative stuff as well as kind of liaising with the gallery's artists?
Yeah. So, you know, on paper, I started as a gallery assistant and became an associate director by the time I left. In practice, though, like so many galleries out there, I mean, we were small and then we were big at one point. I think there were about 15 employees when, you know, Javier had spaces in like three different locations. And then after the financial crisis and collapse, we went down to two spaces and our job descriptions changed again. So,
right.
Yeah, we kind of did everything. You know, we had a director, we had a gallery manager, and then we had the sort of gallery assistant position and then a registrar and preparator. But it involved everything from like, you know, being an artist liaison, which was amazing, working with them to work on everything from like publications to making large scale projects happen, and working with museums when artists had, you know, retrospectives or solo shows. And that was fun, you know, and that was kind of standard project management. So doing mm-hmm. everything from tracking down image rights for the catalog to, you know, getting shipping quotes for these, you know, insane works. Like, you know, Terrence Coe has this one work that has like 3,000 different pieces in it. These like white heads that allegedly contain everything from like cocaine and traces of bodily fluid to powder and chocolate, and each head is encased in a glass vitrine, and the heads are not anchored, so they roll around. So, yeah, you know, try figuring out a way to get that from Berlin to Leon, Spain, without any
wow.
of those breaking. I mean, those were the kinds of interesting challenges that we faced, and, you know, it would go from there. There was this one night, too, where I think I was just like, what is my job, really? When we did this, it was this amazing project by Terrence Coe and Bruce LaBruce. So those are both Canadian artists. And I'm not sure if you know Bruce LaBruce. He actually recently had a sort of, I think it was a retrospective actually at MoMA just this last year. He's a Canadian filmmaker known for doing they're basically pornographic films, or he's called himself the reluctant pornographer.
Mm-hmm.
And Terrence Coe is this also very provocative artist who sort of went off the grid for a while and recently made a huge return, a huge splash back into the New York art scene. And a lot of his work, it tends to be, it's sculptural. He also does video and performance, and the works are, you know, often very meditative and use his own sort of personal iconography and are in, you know, monochromatic colors. In any event, they banded together to do this very odd, very awesome event called Blame Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like the South Park song from the movie.
Right.
And we worked with this production company in Berlin who turned this entire space that was about 1,400 square meters into the bar from the Twin Peaks movie Fire Walk With Me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so it was like a movie set. And
right.
They managed to pull it together in, you know, a few weeks. But, of course, as it often happens, by the, you know, leading up to opening night, everyone's scrambling to get things done. And so it was like me, the gallery director, a number of our art handlers, painting the rest of the walls of this white cube space black at like 2 o'clock in the morning for the opening the next day.
Wow.
I just remember being like, wow, this is job is never ceases to be interesting. I can give it that.
Right. And do you think, considering the time that that was happening, because what year was that exactly, that installation you're referring to?
I want to say that was 2007.
Okay,
so I think that was still a little bit before the crash.
Right.
You know, when we had the budget to just have a 1,400 square foot exhibition space for special projects.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I'm just, what I was getting at, as you probably anticipated, is if you were to move ahead at, you know, just a year and a half or so, that whole thing would have been unimaginable because there's no budget. Is that right?
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're going from helicopters to Mykonos to a pair down staff and stable.
A pair down staff, right. And like a few furloughed months. But no, we made it through. And I will give Javier that. Like, I should also mention in all of this, like, I absolutely loved working for Javier. Mm. He is just this bundle of energy who is like constantly onto the next thing, has so many different ideas and vision, and was just an inspiration to work with. So I just wanted to put that on the table that, you know, and through all of this, I think what was probably tough is, you know, he's kind of known for being a little bit larger than life, and a lot of his artists' works were huge projects. And when he actually started out his gallery, he was not going to represent artists. He wanted to do projects, hence Perez projects. And he did these humongous ones. You know, I think his first show was with Bruce LaBruce. He worked with Assume Vivid Astrofocus,
mm-hmm.
You know, the sort of Brazilian collective that, you know, has done things like at MoCA, and their installations are multicolored, multifaceted, cost thousands and thousands of dollars to produce. And I think he realized at some point that that's not a great business model because you can't sell those things. But still, he managed to have a really viable business while doing these incredible passion projects. And what I think was tough in the crash is that there was a bit of a reckoning throughout the art world. And the glitz and glamour of, you know, a few years before all of a sudden was very gauche. There was actually this great Guardian article, I think, about the, you know, the Gilded Age being over and how all of this bling art, you know, was not like, Damien Hirst's diamond encrusted skull is kind of the crucible of this moment in time. But, you know, that kind of no longer became, you know, seen as tasteful. And I think it's hard to reposition yourself when you're a gallery who has often been associated with excess. But Javier did it successfully. And, you know, it was tough. Like, we definitely constricted a lot, but he managed to pull through and has, you know, a different program now in certain ways, but a really interesting one, and one that I think is still true to, you know, true to himself and his idea of what he thinks good art is.
And is it now just in Berlin, or is it still in New York as well?
Yeah, it's just in Berlin.
Right, okay. Going back to Assume Vivid Astrofocus, because I remember actually discovering him through Perez Projects, I thought it was just the pen name or the nomenclature for one guy, one Brazilian guy.
Okay, well, yeah. So Ellie Sudbrack is the guy,
right.
The guy behind it. But I think they do also, like, he works collaboratively with a lot of people. So we would typically talk about them as a collective. You know, the lines are blurred there. I think, though, that, like, I would want to say, you know, to kind of be, like, you know, in true faith to his idea, I think, of what it is. like each show that they did would have a different name. Like the artist name on the show would be different, and it would a sort of play on the acronym AVAF. Assume Vivid Astrofocus is AVAF, and there was, oh gosh, I can't remember even any of the other ones that they come up with, but like every show would have different words that relate to that acronym.
Right, got it. I'm wondering, you know, with the hindsight of 10 or almost 10 years, and we have a very different lens now in or certain parts of the art world, I should say, have a very different lens. I wonder if either now especially or even to some extent then, how cognizant you were of this, not necessarily, you can tell me if it's anywhere close to being accurate, but this sort of bro culture, or at the very least, it was a very male-dominant gallery culture, correct?
Yeah, totally. So I will first say that it feels a little bit funny for me at like my ripe old age of mid-30s to like talk about the benefits of hindsight. I'm sure
that's a good point.
Anyone older than me would think that this is like a very quaint or, right. or kind of cutely naive exercise.
Right.
But okay, since you've asked me to go down that path, totally. You know, and there was this one great show, oh my gosh, I'm not going to remember it, I don't think, but I think it was like one of the Prague Biennials, and who was this curator's name? I think the title of the show was supposed to be something like Motherfucking Male Artist Painters or something, and they weren't like allowed to use that because of the swear in it, but that was, and then it was actually going to be like all female artists. But there was totally this rivalry between some of the like non-big male painters. You know, like Dan Colin is definitely a prime example of that, like big macho male painter.
Right.
And we were aware of that when it was happening. You know, I don't think that it was any big secret. And I think that what was interesting though about the gallery that I worked at is that we represented both sides. So, you know, we worked with Dan Colin, but then we also worked with Christina Ropstorff, who is a Danish collage artist. And I think that I've always loved her work. I've always been drawn to it and drawn to collage. And I don't know. That's kind of, I guess, all I have to say on the topic.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely don't want to, I'm not accusing you of anything. It's just that there was a gallerist, a female gallerist who, I won't mention the name, but she curated a big show kind of around that time, maybe a couple of years later, that had, you know, some of these artists in it. And and she in a maybe a catalog piece or just an article talking about that clique, if you will, you know, she just mentioned, you know, this dude who knew this dude, and then, you know, all these dudes were hanging out. It was just like, it was mentioned actually in, I think, one of my prior guests' articles, that all these dudes were being mentioned, and she was kind of facilitating, you know, to some extent, that culture. And I know, being in the position that you were in, that wasn't your role at all, but it's clear that you had some perspective on it even then.
Yeah, no, and I think I can guess which curator you're talking about.
Right.
And I, you know, I think also to a certain extent that it's not a fair assumption that just because a woman curator comes in that she's going to put women artists forward, or that she's going to, you know, have an aesthetic that is particularly womanly. And, you know, that's kind of like always also the, I don't know, an issue of expecting people to be like native informants, so to speak, for their subgroup. I think it's absolutely important to have more women artists working. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
Like we, and I know a lot of them, and I'm friends with them. And on the Art Genome Project, we're always talking about like, how do we have, you know, how do we bring more exposure to the women artists on the platform? It's a major part of what we do. So I don't want people to think that, you know, I expect that things should, or that things are just fine or should continue as they are. But I do think that it's unfair to assume that just because someone is of a particular, like, you know, non-dominant subgroup, that they're going to reflect your ideas of what diversity means. So I wanted to ask you too, because I think that there was also a little bit of a different scene in Germany with the big male painters versus the U.S. And I think part of that is that there is also different cultural traditions of painting. Is that accurate to say? Because I wasn't in New York actually, from 2004 to 2010.
Right. That's an interesting question. Well, certainly the old cliche, of male macho German painters, goes back quite a ways. I think it's yeah, I think it's something that it exists certainly existed here with less obviousness, around them. And it's something that we go back to the beginning and you mentioned how much has changed just in 10 years since 2006, and that's another thing that is changing quite a bit. If it's not changing enough for some people, it is certainly being referred to often. You know what I mean? Like the Richard Princes of the world are becoming these sort of go-to bad guys with what's wrong with the art world and that kind of thing. So, yeah, that's kind of how I see it. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. But I think also too, that moment is kind of past. I mean, I think big macho painting is always going to be there to a certain extent, but I don't think that that's really as much of a relevant lens for today. And not to say that women painters have made it and they're perfectly fine. They're not. I mean, I think it's what, aren't there still only three women or something who have ever sold a work for more than $1 million at auction? It's yeah, and that's absolutely batty. But I think we're lucky in New York. If you look at any of the last Whitney biennials, for example, not only were there female curators involved, but a lot of the works were not even painting. They were, quite diverse. You had artists like Forrest Best being brought in, who's just a really, fascinating figure. And I think that you actually spoke with Michelle Grabner, right? On this program. Yeah, right. I loved her, her contribution to the Whitney Biennial. And it was great to see Sheila Hicks's works in such a prominent stage there. And what was great about it too to me was seeing there was a part of me that was I should know that this is important, that someone like Sheila Hicks, this textile artist, is having this, humongous moment and big comeback and being shown amongst all of these young painters today. But at the same time, I was like, this looks so natural. It looks great. It's beautiful work and it stands on its own. And we don't have to take it as an indication that, we've reached some goal when it comes to, women being more included in the conversation. So, yeah.
Got it. What was the transition like from Perez Projects to, was it Phillips Auction House that you went to?
It was. Well, I actually left the gallery to go to grad school, and that definitely made for an easy transition. I think that I had gotten to a point where I knew that if I wanted to make a move and get even more out of my career, then I had to develop a point of view, and I just wanted to learn more about art. So, yeah, I decided to go back to grad school, and Javier was very gracious about it and very generous as I left and came back. And it was around then that I got a part-time job actually at Phillips, was how I started there, and then that developed into kind of a full-time role. But it was kind of shocking. I think when I returned back to New York, and the New York and the Berlin art scenes are just so different.
I'm glad you mentioned
I
that
think that,
because I was really curious how you found the two of them.
yeah, I think that, and this does relate to why I think the job at Phillips was so different and such a big transition for me. But so the main difference between the two of them is that Berlin has a very small collector base. We always thought of Berlin as kind of like Europe's playground. It has, I think it might still be the case that not a single company on the docks, like the German Stock Exchange, is headquartered in Berlin. I know that was the case when I left. Maybe it's changed, but I do think that goes to show that it's not a huge money place. The money in Germany, it's in the south, it's in Frankfurt. And Berlin, since even the 1800s was kind of this outpost of sorts. So even though the, you know, the government is seated there, it really is still like not a collector's city, which means that the big power brokers in the art world there are more the curators, the big gallery owners, and some of the artists. Mm. And I think that just makes for a very different fabric of the art world than you have in New York, where you have the major auction houses, in addition, of course, to the major museums and galleries. But the, you know, the just pure sums of money to changing hands are, I think, are just immense in comparison. So, you know, that kind of translated, I think, to my experience in the auction house, which was just coming from this very artist-focused job and diving straight into the, you know, one of the most commercial elements of the art world that you could, was really just night and day.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, and you mentioned the amazing, the awe-inspiring amounts of capital that you know were going on in New York as compared to Berlin. To what extent was that something you were exposed to kind of directly in your job?
You know, when I started in my job at Phillips, I was very low level. I was what's called client services, so mm-hmm. it's basically front desk. Mm-hmm. And after a while, I moved into this thing called special projects, which this, you know, friend at the time would always call like waterworks. It was like special project sounds like, you know, some code name for a government operative. Mm-hmm. But that was really amazing. I worked with someone there named Filey Knight, and the idea was to kind of put together events and curated selling exhibitions, especially since Phillips doesn't have as dense an auction calendar as the, you know, larger auction houses like Sotheby's and Christie's. And so we were kind of putting together this curatorial program, and that as well was a little bit removed, just because we were focusing a little bit more on the, you know, thematic elements. And by the end of it, yeah, of course, we had to put together projections for how much the selling exhibition was going to make. And, you know, then you're starting to look at humongous sums of money. But I didn't actually work closely with clients there, so I think I was maybe spared the worst of it. No, I don't want to say it that way. And you know, many museums buy their works at auction houses, and you need a market for art to thrive, and you need a secondary market for artists to have a good primary market. You know, I get that. But I think that, you know, it was very clear to me that my future in the art world didn't necessarily rest with selling art to billionaires or millionaires.
Right. And something that correct me if I'm wrong, we briefly alluded to when we spoke before, is that there was something about the auction house. I don't know if it's Phillips any more so than the others, but that was very sort of straight-laced and kind of old school and traditional. Was that your experience?
Yes and no. And it's funny because Phillips does have a reputation for being a little bit more experimental with things. And they did certainly have elements of that. And I think a lot of that did come from, you know, Simone de Puri's personality.
But getting back to where I was going to go with your sort of overview from your experiences there, taking that to your overview overall, because one of the things that I'm interested in sort of exploring always in terms of the art world is how the machinations as far as power and you know, and taste and sensibility and so on, you know, kind of rise. And obviously there are a lot of different factors going on. But all that said, what maybe comes to mind for you from, you know, the sort of the, if you will, cutting edge gallery world to the auction world, now to the digital marketplace world? What kinds of things come to mind, just, you know, off the top of your head without thinking too hard about it, as far as how things sort of rise up through the chaff, if you will?
You mean like how art and how artists rise up through that and rise to prominence?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you could take it that way. You could also take it in terms of important museum shows. You could take it in terms of auction, you know, activity. You could take it in terms of, I don't know if there's the sort of the online equivalent, you know, maybe at some point Artsy will have its, I mean, you already do have auctions, am I right? to some extent.
We do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's an. I mean, and I imagine that an artsy auction is parallel or very comparable to a brick and mortar auction, but you know, just yeah, all those sort of platforms. What comes to mind?
Gosh, this is so tough. And I'm sorry if I'm prevaricating here while I kind of buy myself some time. But this reminds me actually of a talk that I gave recently. It was a TEDx talk on why you don't get contemporary art. And so, of course,
that's
like
awesome,
style,
Jessica. When did you do that?
It was
that?
Great. This was a few months ago. I want to say it was in April.
And was it in New York?
I can send you the link. It was in New York. Yeah, it was part of the like Cornell TEDx series.
Wow.
So not TED, it was TEDx, the diminutive version.
Sure, sure.
But
it's the more local version.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right, but so, okay, so, you know, it's TEDx format, so it has to be like 18 minutes or under. You have to have a very like clear thesis and speak in just a very accessible way. And distill, you know, I was distilling like 250 years of art history into 5 minutes. So,
right.
You know, the gist, right. So the gist of it is that it's like, you know, the three reasons you don't get art are like, one, it's the art world. You know, the art world is this like complex organism. It's difficult to penetrate. The other one is, two, it's like the role of art. What is art? And that goes back, you know, our current view of what art is goes back like 250 years to, you know, the invention of art. And that's also a term used by the historian Eric Schreiner. The idea that before the Enlightenment, most artists were actually artisans. They were usually paid as well, if not, you know, more poorly actually than like decorative artists. And it was only with the Enlightenment and this, you know, the idea that ideas matter so much that art became first and foremost about ideas. So then from there, you know, ideas are very difficult to get. And when artists make work that's primarily about ideas, you know, there was actually a movement called conceptual art that sort of said that art is ideas or the idea is the primary aspect of art, and materials and technique are secondary. So, you know, I kind of went through that whole thing and felt like I was able to do a pretty good job of explaining why art today is not just like pretty pictures. And then I also showed as part of this Joseph Kosuth's One in Three Chairs, you know, seminal work of conceptual art. It's basically from, I think it was 1962, 63, a chair, it's an installation, a chair, a photograph of a chair hung on the wall, and then the dictionary definition printed out and hung on the wall. So this is like a prime example of conceptual art because it basically is asking the question, like, how is meaning made? Is it visual? Is it semantic? Is it an index of the thing itself? So a woman after the presentation basically came up to me and asked this question that I hate getting, and I'm sure you get this all the time, and it's actually so hard to answer, which is, okay, so, you know, I understand that art is about concepts, and I understand it's not about beauty, and it has a certain role in society, but how come Joseph Kosuth can, like, put a chair up in a museum and call it art, and I can't do that? So
I get that question that was, all the time.
Right, right. So that was kind of a long-winded way of saying that that's basically what you're asking me with your question of like how things bubble up to the surface. And I still don't know if I have a great answer to that other than like in the same way that it's difficult to say who gets to be a famous musician. Joseph Kosuth was really good at his job as an artist, and it's a job to be an artist, you know.
Right.
A lot of people don't think of it that way, but it is, and that involves not just making the work and having the ideas and having the education you need for it, but, you know, knowing people and putting in your time and building a resume, just like any other job. And I think what's confusing about it is that those details of like, what does it mean to build an art resume are much more foreign to people than the idea that you like start at a company and do an internship and move your way up. but it really is, you know, in many ways kind of the same, you know, the same concept.
Yeah.
Just in a different field.
Sure. I have a thought about your TED Talk, which I want to mention.
Yes.
First, I want to say, in response to this woman's question, I asked a mentor of mine when I was young, when I think we were in a mall or some type of situation where you have one of those kind of crappy-ish galleries with the prints, you know, the lithographs and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some Campbell's soup can lithographs in this place. And I said, I could have done that. And this mentor said to me, but you didn't.
Right.
You know, so that's the short answer to that phenomena. But more specifically, the thing that came to mind when you're talking about your thesis is, and I don't know if this would be of any use to the type of person who came up to you afterwards, but I think of it as when you're dealing with challenging work, which is what progressive work aspires to, it takes a long enough time to speak the language of, you know, more accessible art, let alone more challenging art. So mm-hmm. that is one way that art is elite and you know, and just not very accessible. Another answer, though, to sort of your description is, well, that's why there's street art, you know, or what have you, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. that version of the art world, because that kind of work tends to favor great accessibility. And so it's the kind of thing where people can walk in off the street and you know, and embrace it right away and get it right away. So that's kind of how I sort of very simplistically, you know, describe the, you know, these two different entry points.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great way of describing it. I'm going to have to note that for the next time I get that question, for sure. Well, and I guess for me, I kind of always come back to this idea that there's actually like no one art world. You
right.
know, I think that, you know, you and I both went to Hunter, and so I'm sure everyone we went to school with there has this particular idea of what the art world is.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there is definitely the certain art world that contains a few thousand galleries, maybe certain number of art fairs and museums. But you're absolutely right to compare something like street art to East German art, because they operate in just such a different system from this, like, you know, art world capital A that, mm-hmm. you know, we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And in East Germany, of course, it was all state-funded art. So the way that art gets made is that there's a budget that comes from the state. And if you're an artist, you get paid a stipend and you can sell something and it'll typically go to the state. And sometimes you could sell things to the West or outside of Germany. And then even then, the state set up all of these, you know, bureaucracies to handle those transactions and took some 50% of them. So it was a very, you know, different time for art and a different, very, very different system. And the main premise was that art was for the public and it was meant to edify and uplift them.
Mm. Was the artist that you did your thesis on, right? It was an East German mm-hmm. artist. Was that the type of art that
yeah.
they did?
Not really. And that's where the story gets a little bit more complex.
Right.
Yeah. So he was working in so I guess I should mention again, you know, East Germany existed from 1949 up until 1989.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of this generation of artists called the original Leipzig School of Painters, very active in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And this group is what ultimately kind of gave birth to the new Leipzig School, which might be more familiar to your listeners. So like Neo Rauch is a new
right.
Leipzig School painter. Right. So Leipzig was actually didn't have a historic art university in the same way that like Dresden did with its longstanding painting tradition, but it did have a book and sort of a literary culture. And so there was also in turn a long-standing culture of like graphic illustration and prints, and that carried through in the work that the Leipzig School painters were doing. So it was very, of course, it was figurative, but it came out of a longer tradition than just the sort of state-given figuration
mm-hmm.
That many other artists were doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this the state-dictated style was kind of an import from socialist realism in Russia, but Leipzig had a real homegrown tradition of figuration. And these artists in that school were able to develop enough of a following and enough of an importance that they could actually countermand a lot of the restrictions that had been placed on state art. So these restrictions included things like, showing happy people generally, and showing events that were part of the general GDR or East German iconography.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to introduce a modicum of enigma and symbolism and allegory into their work and create ultimately very complex, oftentimes dark works that to a certain extent did undermine a lot of the political messages that, the GDR leadership was trying to send out via art. It's basically art was one of the arms of its propaganda machine. And mm-hmm. these artists were able to get around that.
Right. When you did your TEDx talk, was it your sort of persona, if you will, connected to the Genome Project, or was it in your, because obviously that was before your current liaison position, right?
It was, yes. I would say that it was connected more broadly to Artsy's mission of access.
Mm. Okay.
That is something that I also feel deeply about.
Right.
So that
right.
made the connection pretty easy.
Yeah, because as you were describing, the East German and the Leipzig schools and so on, I was thinking, wow, you really, that talk and what you're talking about now is something you're really connected to, and I just wonder how you reconcile that kind of passion with, more of a marketplace type of situation and the fact that you're getting to do, outreach work, for lack of a better term. I was actually wondering with you, managing the liaisons of Artsy, so doing a lot of managing, in other words, mm-hmm. where you get to tap into that kind of creativity that you got to with the gallery and with the study of the East German scene.
Oh, so on a more personal level, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, managing is definitely creative in and of itself.
Mm.
I think it's the closest job I've ever had to the choreography I was doing in my undergraduate.
Right.
So it's actually pretty awesome. It's more creative, I think, than studying East German art, which involves actually just reading through a lot of meeting notes from various sessions that the arts councils had. So I think in that regard, I'm actually very lucky. And then, we're close to the subject matter. We follow our gallery's programs and we go to see them in person.
Right. Got it. Is there any kind of choreography move that you pull off on a regular basis, managing your people?
Oh my gosh, that's kind of embarrassing. No, it's more just like stretches. I like to do a few power poses in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good answer. Okay. I was just kind of like, you set up this image for me. You've got your 20 liaisons that you're managing, and I just couldn't help but, okay, this is how we're gonna tackle this escalator. Okay, ready, go.
Right.
It's like it's like, what was that movement? The where you have people in the Target or whatever, all performing, something spontaneous, that spontaneous sort of performance thing.
Oh, like a flash mob?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was a particular name for it that I'm totally forgetting, but yeah, like a flash mob. Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. No, we don't coordinate in that way. And it's definitely not like a ballet or like it's not like the Rockettes either.
Right.
I think that it's more like a modern dance in that.
Yeah.
No, really, really, there's an analogy here.
Good.
Okay, which is that when you're dancing, and if you look at like videos of how any choreographer has worked, any like fantastic choreographer like Mark Morris or Paul Taylor, whose work I love, and when he works with his dancers, it's very custom. He'll get in a room with them and sort of put on music, and they start improvising, and you use that to sort of formulate the trajectory of the piece and the individual movements. And a lot of, you know, that's for creating solo pieces, of course, but then also for ensemble work. Every person has their own style, and you can train them as much as you want. There's always going to be stylistic differences amongst dancers. And so as a choreographer, your role is to find the, you know, the movement and the vision and moving together amongst all of the diversity. So I feel like that's a great metaphor for management.
Well, I cannot applaud you enough for bringing it around back to the beginning. That is a job well done.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Jessica. This is great. I really, really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Michael. It was my pleasure.
And we're out. Thank you so much again to Jessica Backus. Real pro, as you can tell, by bringing it back around like that. A little choreographed acrobatics going on there at the end. If you like this show and would like to show your support, there are a number of ways you can support the show. One is by going to theconversationpod.com/support. Donations are extremely appreciated. I love getting these emails saying you have received a donation, and I only get them if you go to theconversationpod.com/support. Donate through PayPal. It's simple. It's easy. I will not make any mention of you if you want to be anonymous, but if you want a little credit, I will give you a shout out either way. You can also, of course, follow the show on social media, on Instagram and Twitter. It's at Artist Podcast. Facebook, we're getting close to that milestone number. And again, St. Kitts Island beckons you if you hit that magic number. So I would like the show if I were you. If you don't, you never know. It's also very helpful if you go to the iTunes page of the show, link through the site, but also you go to iTunes and you look up the Conversation and Artist Podcast and you'd leave us a nice review, ideally 5 stars, something nice, and that'll help other people find the show, which is always extremely important. Of course, spreading the word is also greatly appreciated. And do let us know what you thought of this episode or any other by leaving a comment on social media or writing theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you for being here. Thank you for celebrating, as it were, episode 150. And I have some exciting guests coming up, 151, 152, 153. So stay tuned for them. Thank you again for being here. I appreciate it. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.